Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 582, Retrospective on the Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. This has been recorded on January 21st of the year 2007. In the latter part of 2006, a movie, Bobby, was released. It is a major Hollywood production about the assassination of Robert Kennedy. It is not an investigative piece per se, according to the reviews, it is not particularly factually accurate. It isn't necessarily meant to be. Right about that time, and who knows, perhaps inspired by that, BBC Newsnight carried a revelation that alleges that some CIA, high-ranking CIA personnel were present at the Ambassador Hotel on June 5, 1968, when Robert Kennedy was assassinated, and speculates about the possibility that these CIA officers may have been involved in the assassination. This is from BBC Newsnight from November 20th of 2006. This print-up is headlined, CIA Role Claim in Kennedy Killing. New video and photographic evidence that puts three senior CIA operatives at the scene of Robert Kennedy's assassination has been brought to light. And the text reads, the evidence was shown in a report by Shane O'Sullivan, broadcast on BBC Newsnight. It reveals that the operatives and four unidentified associates were at the Ambassador Hotel Los Angeles in the moments before and after the shooting on June 5, 1968. The CIA had no domestic jurisdiction, and some of the officers were based in Southeast Asia at the time, with no reason to be in Los Angeles. Kennedy had just won the California Democratic primary on an anti-war ticket and was set to challenge Richard Nixon for the White House when he was shot in a kitchen pantry. A 24-year-old Palestinian, Saran Saran, was arrested as the lone assassin, and notebooks at his house seemed to incriminate him. However, under hypnosis, Saran has never been able to remember the shooting, and defense psychiatrists concluded he was in a trance at the time. Witnesses placed Saran's gun several feet in front of Kennedy, but the autopsy showed the fatal shot came from 1 inch behind. Dr. Herbert Spiegel, a world authority on hypnosis at Columbia University, believes Saran may have been hypnotically programmed to act as a decoy for the real assassin. The report is a result of a 3-year investigation by filmmaker Shane O'Sullivan. He reveals new video and photographs showing three senior CIA operatives at the hotel. Three of these men had been positively identified as senior officers who worked together in 1963 at JM Wave, the CIA's Miami base for its secret war on Castro. David Morales was chief of operations and once told friends, quote, I was in Dallas when we got the son of a bitch, and I was in Los Angeles when we got the little bastard, unquote. Gordon Campbell was chief of maritime operations, and George Ioannidis was chief of psychological warfare operations. Ioannidis was called out of retirement in 1978 to act as the CIA liaison to the congressional investigation into the JFK assassination. Now, we see him at the Ambassador Hotel the night a second Kennedy is assassinated. Or Monday, November 20th, would have been Bobby Kennedy's 81st birthday. In Los Angeles, his son Max has just broken ground on a new high school project in memory of his father on the old Ambassador Hotel site. Paul Schrade, a key figure behind the school project, was walking behind Robert Kennedy that night and was shot in the head. He believes the new evidence merits fresh investigation. It seems very strange to me that these guys would be at a Kennedy celebration. What were they doing there, and why were they there? It's our obligation as friends of Bob Kennedy to investigate this, unquote. Ed Lopez, a former congressional investigator who worked with Ioannidis in 1978, says, I think the key people at the CIA need to go back to anybody who might have been around back then, bring them in and interview them and ask, is this Gordon Campbell? Is this George Ioannidis, unquote? Well, I've never heard these particular allegations before, so I can't comment one way or another on their accuracy. What is a matter of record, though, is that Saran Saran could not have killed Kennedy. What we're going to do now is to dip into the archives. We're going to be going back into the archives. Specifically, we're going to be going back to AFA program number 9, recorded on June 5th of 1985, the 17th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's assassination. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. For our information about the Robert Kennedy assassination, we are relying on the book, The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, co-authored by William W. Turner and John Christian. A hardcover edition was published in 1978 by Random House. That's the edition we're using here. In 1992, the book was re-released in softcover. We're going to begin by reflecting on the contradictions in the ballistics evidence, which prove that Saran, standing anywhere from 2 to 11 feet in front of Kennedy, could not have been the assassin. Then you're going to hear about Thane Eugene Caesar, the probable assassin, an individual with white supremacist connections, an individual who was working as a security guard in the Kennedy assassination, and one who has dissembled about his owning a gun identical or of the same caliber as the one that killed Robert Kennedy. So this is from AFA program number 9 from June 5th, 1985.
This is basically, we've set the stage now. We're going to start talking about, not just Turner and Christian, but largely Turner and Christian's findings and some other people's findings as we begin to go over the evidence and the conflicting evidence specifically to the Sirhan as the lone assassin without aid, without conspiratorial backup of any kind. Okay, continuing. Reading a little further on from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Eyewitnesses uniformly recounted that Sirhan accosted Kennedy from the front and never got closer than 2 to 3 feet from the senator before he was grabbed and wrestled to the floor. And I should just say parenthetically that 2 to 3 feet was the closest estimate. Most of the estimates were actually 4 to 7 feet.
Some as far away as 11, by the way. So 2 to 3, again, as Nip Tuck appropriately said, that was the closest. Most 4 to 7, some as far away as 11.
Yet County Coroner Dr. Thomas T. Noguchi, who performed the autopsy, declared that all three of the bullets striking Kennedy entered from the rear in a flight path from down to up, right to left. Moreover, powder burns around the entry wound indicated that the fatal bullet was fired at less than 1 inch from the head and no more than 2 to 3 inches behind the right ear. Okay, let me just go over this really quickly because this is, of course, one of the keynote pieces of evidence in the entire case. Okay, the presumption of Sirhan as the assassin is that Sirhan, as all the eyewitnesses recounted, came up to Kennedy from the front, fired on him from the front, at least 2 shots, and then was grabbed by several people and continued to fire as he was pulled down. Okay? So we have a face-to-face, front-to-front shooting. But now the county coroner, noting stapling or powder burns on the wound, concludes that the wounds, especially the fatal wound, were within inches, and especially one of them within an inch. Okay? When none of the witnesses said that Sirhan was any closer than several feet, which will not produce those kind of powder burns, and that, in fact, the wounds were from the rear when, as we said before, Kennedy was shot from the front. He covered his face as he fell. Everybody saw him being shot from the front. Okay, going on. Thus, it would have been physically impossible for Sirhan to have fired the shots that struck Kennedy, even allowing for the remote possibility that Kennedy twisted completely around, which is contrary to witnesses' accounts, that he threw his arms in front of his face in a protective reaction and sagged backwards. There remained the point-blank shot. Noguchi later revealed that before he entered the grand jury room, he was approached by an unnamed deputy DA who solicited him to revise the distance, quote, from 1 to 3 inches, which is Noguchi's estimate, to 1 to 3 feet. The coroner bravely refused to cooperate, quote unquote, with this blatant attempt to suborn perjury.
So again, recall that the coroner's inquest, The autopsy results concluded that the fatal shot had been fired from a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of Kennedy's head, from the bullets traveled from down to up and from right to left. And again, restating this, because many people who were listening were not alive at the time of the Robert Kennedy assassination or were too young to have really paid much attention to the event, that, again, Sirhan accosts Kennedy in a very crowded pantry, fires or allegedly fires shots at him from a distance of anywhere from 2 to 11 feet in front of Kennedy, according to the various eyewitnesses. Fatal shot fired from a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of his head, and notice here already an attempted cover-up when a deputy DA attempted to solicit incorrect testimony from Coroner Noguchi. Incidentally, people who would like to seek contemporary corroboration of this autopsy result. Noguchi is author of a book which is currently out in softcover called Coroner, which doesn't go into the Robert Kennedy case in terms of the criminal aspects of it in any great detail, but it does recount and repeat Noguchi's finding that the fatal shot was fired from, a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of Senator Robert Kennedy's head. Again, from the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by Turner and Christian. Although the DA and LAPD continued to insist that only assassination freaks were raising questions about the shooting, Baxter Ward is an LA County supervisor, Baxter Ward finally garnered enough votes from his fellow supervisors to officially request that the Superior Court order a reexamination of the firearms evidence. On September 18, 1975, presiding judge Robert A. Wenke, W-E-N-K-E, complied. A 7-man panel of firearms experts was named. No sooner had the panel begun work than it was confronted with several baffling questions. For one, the LAPD unaccountably could not produce the laboratory records supporting its claim that in 1968 it test-fired 8 bullets from Saran's gun. For another, the gun's bore was heavily coated with lead, yet copper-jacketed bullets such as Saran allegedly fired leave a lead-free bore. The panel simply noted the leaded condition. 2 copper-jacketed bullets were fired to clean out the lead so the testing could go ahead, and did not speculate on how it happened. On Election Day, June 4th, Saran had practiced rapid shooting for about 7 hours on a San Gabriel range using unjacketed wad-cutter target bullets which deposit lead in the bore. If this was the source of the extreme leading, he could not have fired copper-jacketed bullets of the type recovered from the victims and supposedly matched to his gun by Wolfer, for they would have cleaned out the lead. And Wolfer could not have test-fired bullets of that type to make the match, for they, too, would have had a cleaning effect.
It should just be mentioned real quickly that the man Wolfer that they're referring to is the police ballistics expert who was brought in to make the initial findings, and as we will see, or as we are seeing now, despite a great deal of inconsistencies, questions, and downright impossibilities, found in favor of the conclusion that Sirhan's gun had fired all the bullets.
And a man who was regarded as being of less than perfect integrity by a lot of his compatriots. A lot of his peers regarded him as being unreliable. But that's who this particular individual here is. A third mystery revolves around the Kennedy and Weisel bullets, Weisel being a witness in the pantry who was also wounded during the shooting. A third mystery revolved around the Kennedy and Weisel bullets. W-E-I-S-E-L is Weisel, by the way. After test-firing Saran's gun, the experts were startled to observe that the test bullets did not bear the microscopic indentations that appeared on the Kennedy and Weisel bullets, as well as on a bullet Wolfer had introduced at the trial of Saran as having been test-fired from Saran's gun. Nor did the indentations appear on photographs that Bill Harper took with the Balliscan camera for his 1971 comparisons. By the way, Bill Harper is a ballistics expert who worked with Turner and Christian on the case and came up with very different results than Dwayne Wolfer, the LAPD ballistics expert just mentioned. Repeating that last sentence, nor did the indentations appear on photographs that Bill Harper took with his Balliscan camera for his 1971 comparisons, but they were visible on photographs taken for Baxter Ward's 1974 hearing. The indentations could have been made with any sharp object, including the tip of a pencil. They coincided on each bullet, so they could have been mistaken for matching marks. Whoever made them was obviously hoping to reinforce the single assassin position. The tampering must have been done sometime after Bill Harper's examination, which concluded that the bullets did not match. By the time Harper made public his findings and the second gun controversy erupted, the bullets were in the custody of the California Supreme Court in San Francisco. We learned from a clerk in the exhibit section of the Supreme Court that in July of 1971, about the time Joe Bush was announcing that he would look into the firearms discrepancies, a contingent from the DA's office, the LAPD, and Attorney General Younger's office visited the Supreme Court offices and spent several hours alone examining the Saran gun and the evidence bullets. So reviewing the information just related in this passage, a number of interesting things crop up in terms of the LAPD's handling of the bullets, the testing of the gun, and so forth. First of all, the laboratory record which would support the LAPD's claim of having test-fired Saran's gun was unavailable. Second, lead deposits appear on the bore, which can't be accounted for considering that Saran was firing copper-jacketed bullets, and that in order to clean out the lead for a subsequent test firing of the gun, all the LAPD had to do was to fire 2 copper-jacketed rounds of the type Saran fired, and that cleaned the lead out of the bore. So the question is, if the LAPD had been firing the kind of bullets Saran had been firing, where did that lead come from? There was no record of the bullets out of the gun having been fired after that. Another little problem which crops up here is that wad cutters, at least to the best of my knowledge, are not made in .22 caliber. So, again, I don't know how that lead got there. I don't know where Turner and Christian are talking about the wad cutters, but to the best of my knowledge, wad cutters are not even made in .22 caliber. But at any rate, the lead cannot be accounted for according to the information the LAPD has presented. Another interesting thing is the fact that the bullets had markings at certain times and not at others, and there appears to have been a very timely visit between the time the bullets, between one of the examinations which did not reveal these characteristic markings, and the time Bill Harper examined them and found that they were there. So apparently someone, again, recall the attempt to get Coroner Noguchi to change his findings in the autopsy, someone has, even at this relatively early date, at an early stage of our examination of the Robert Kennedy assassination, is going to some length to try and support fallaciously the single assassin theory. And again, recall the position of Saran in the pantry and where the bullets came from.
Now, something also to try and put this in perspective, one needs to realize or needs to think back and realize that the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy was arguably the second most important murder in the United States in the last 50 years. I mean, you know, probably post William McKinley. I mean, this was probably one of the major murder cases of our century. And as you will go through this with us tonight, you will see that the record of sort of spurious complexity on the part of the Los Angeles Police Department is balanced out and in fact overwhelmed by the at best completely cavalier treatment of evidence, of the testimony of witnesses, and that's the best possible way of interpreting it. As you will see, there's a lot of other ways to interpret it, including the outright destruction of evidence and obstruction of justice and badgering of witnesses and many other things. But so bear in mind, right away, we're already missing some crucial evidence, and some other evidence has been completely ignored, as was mentioned with the lead coating on the inside of the barrel. It just was overlooked by the panel of experts. I mean, one of the most obvious things that could just negate the entire validity of the ballistics test was just ignored. They just went right past it. This is a record that we've seen too many times in other assassinations, and we're going to see it again and again tonight. Okay. Now, about this time that the ballistics evidence was coming out, several people, including Allard Lowenstein, a former Kennedy staffer, a former congressional representative himself, was getting a little upset himself about some of the things going on. He felt himself that there was some kind of dirty business going on that needed to be looked into, and the cross-examining over the ballistic evidence was coming to court. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about Allard Lowenstein later, because he himself met with a rather interesting fate. But what he did do was to contact Vincent Bugliosi, spelled, of course, B-U-G-L-I-O-S-I. Many of you are familiar with Bugliosi because of his involvement as the prosecutor in the Manson case. Bugliosi at that time was one of the best-known prosecutors in the country, probably still is. And he himself was a little reluctant to get involved because he was afraid he'd be seen as grandstanding. But as Lowenstein said, this is heavy-duty stuff. This is very important. This is the death of a presidential candidate. And, you know, there's weird stuff being done to the trial record, and we need you to get involved. So Bugliosi was brought in.
Interestingly, Bugliosi has been accused by many people of having covered up information in the Manson prosecution. There have been contentions that the Manson operation was, in essence, a sort of provocation. We'll go into that in a little bit greater length later in the broadcast. But Bugliosi has been accused of covering up information in the Manson case, so there are questions about his performance there. But in the Robert Kennedy case, he did sort of enlist with Turner and Christian here and played a leading role in their legal efforts to attempt to bring the Robert Kennedy case to justice. And one of the things that he did was to examine the L.A. County Supervisors Board of Ballistics Experts put together. And Niptuck's going to read you a summary and analysis of Bugliosi's cross-examination of them here in a minute.
Okay, again, reading from Turner and Christian. Because Bugliosi's cross-examination of the experts involved sophisticated and highly complicated firearms testimony, which consumed several hundred pages of court transcript, we must necessarily condense the points he established as follows. 1. Although 5 of the 7 experts testified under oath that it was their, quote, belief that 3 of the 7 bullets recovered from the victims, 1 from Robert F. Kennedy, came from Sirhan's gun, not one of the experts was willing to make a positive identification. Positive ID, the authors put in parentheses, is very common in criminal trials. In a case of this magnitude, the lack of a positive identification is of monumental significance. Note, this testimony literally destroyed the LAPD's Dwayne Wilfer's grand jury and trial testimony that he was, quote, 100% sure that all 7 bullets positively came from Sirhan's gun, quote, to the exclusion of all other weapons in the world. And mentioning again parenthetically, it's just interesting again that Dwayne Wilfer is positive of this despite the fact that Sirhan's gun apparently had not fired any of the bullets being used because of the lead jacketing on the inside of it and a variety of other things, including marks that were missing. 2. All 7 experts testified that it was, quote, not their conclusion that there was no second gun involved at the assassination scene, which had been played by the press, that this ballistics commission had said one gun only. I'll read that again. All 7 experts testified that it was not their conclusion that there was no second gun involved at the assassination scene. Their testimony was merely that based on the exhibits they had been furnished, and the authors say they never saw some that they should have, they could find no evidence of a second gun. As Bugliosi would argue, quote, there's more than a semantic distinction involved here. In fact, there's all the difference in the world between no evidence of a second gun and a flat statement that there was no second gun. It would be like my walking down the street and saying I saw no avocados on the street. That doesn't mean there weren't any avocados, only that I didn't see any avocados. 3. 5 of the 7 experts recommended that further scientific tests, ballistics, spectrographics, etc., be conducted. As Bugliosi pointed out to the court, quote, as the court knows, there is a tremendous controversy in this case as to which bullet struck which victim and, based on the uncontested position of Sirhan at the assassination scene, whether it was physically possible for him to have fired all the recovered bullets. If any case ever cried out for a thorough, in-depth, independent ballistics examination, this case is it. A ballistics test, in parentheses, the authors say, attempts to determine the flight path of a bullet. A bullet follows from the moment it leaves the gun muzzle to its ultimate point of rest. 4. 5 out of the 7 experts testified that they did reach a positive conclusion that 3 of the victim bullets had been fired from the, quote, same gun, but they were not able to positively identify Sirhan's gun as being the weapon from which the subject bullets were fired. 5. The experts did acknowledge that there were some, quote, significant differences between the striations, meaning the lines, the markings, the indentations, on several of the victim's bullets and those on the bullets test-fired by the panel from Sirhan's gun. 6. All 7 experts testified that they were unable to determine the number of bullets fired at the assassination scene. 7. All 7 experts testified that they did not rule out the possibility of a second gun. Which is actually the most important point of all, because the press had gone and said, panel says one gun. In reality, as Bugliosi pointed out, the panel said they hadn't seen evidence to support a second gun. But, as the point is made here, all 7 experts testified that they did not rule out the possibility of a second gun. And again, they're getting some rather bizarre and tainted ballistics evidence to deal with, and a gun and a series of shells, slugs that have been apparently manipulated at some point, at least as far as the striations go. Here, fortunately, now memorialized in a courtroom under oath, were the true findings of the 7 experts, not the flat, quote, no second gun reportings of an ill-informed press. The previous written findings of these panelists, which had been misinterpreted by the news media, with the sole exception of CBS reporter Bill Stout, and which appeared to slam the door tight forever on further inquiry, had, due to Bugliosi's deft cross-examination, been reduced to their proper import and accurate legal dimensions. Unfortunately, however, Bugliosi's effort came 3 months too late to eradicate the impression that had been embossed in the public's mind by a mostly unthinking mass media.
So again, summing up here, an official ballistics panel of ballistics experts put together by the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors and denied the best evidence available in the situation still came up with the following conclusions according to Bugliosi. 5 of the 7 experts testified that it was their belief that 3 of the bullets came from Sirhan's gun. Not one of the 7 would make a positive identification, which is a very common thing to have occur in a case like this. All 7 experts testified that they did not conclude that there was no second gun, simply that they had no evidence of one based on the evidence that they had seen. 5 of the 7 experts recommended that further tests be conducted. 5 of the 7 experts said that 3 of the victim bullets did come from the same gun. Not one of them would identify Sirhan's gun as positively being the one from which it had come. The experts acknowledge that there were some significant differences between some of the markings on some of the different bullets. All seven experts testified that they were unable to determine the number of bullets fired at the assassination scene. All experts said they did not rule out the possibility of a second gun. And this is the official finding on the case.
And remember, we're trying to make this cumulative. Remember, the first piece of important evidence that was introduced was the fact that the coroner himself basically said, although he didn't make the logical connection, I mean, he was not allowed to, but he said that his testimony basically said that Sir Han, as observed by many witnesses, could not have fired the fatal shots. They came from an inch to 3 inches behind Robert F. Kennedy, close enough to cause powder burns. Sir Han was not close enough. So we start to see the pattern of the willful distortion of evidence to try and fit into a pattern of a lone gunman, which, again, we have seen this before.
Now, we're going to provide some information now which will indicate who may have fired the fatal shots from the rear of Robert Kennedy, continuing with the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Donald Shulman, S-C-H-U-L-M-A-N, a CBS News employee who was behind Kennedy in the pantry and whose line of vision included both Saran and a uniformed security guard, told radio reporter Jeff Brandt moments after the shooting, quote, "A Caucasian gentleman stepped out and fired three times. The security guard hit Kennedy all three times. Mr. Kennedy slumped to the floor. They carried him away. The security guard fired back." Brandt said, "I heard about six or seven shots in succession. Is this the security guard firing back?" "Yes, the man who stepped out fired three times at Kennedy, hit him all three times, and then the security guard then fired back, hitting him." Shulman apparently thought that the guard fired at Saran, but accidentally hit Kennedy. So basically, we have one, a CBS News employee, basically has testified that a security guard stepped out, the opinion of the CBS News employee, fired three shots at Saran, but accidentally hit Kennedy. So we're going to take a look at whether or not a security guard may have fired shots, and whether or not he hit Kennedy, and if he did, whether or not it was an accident.
That, again, from AFA program number 9, recorded on June 5th of 1985. What we've heard about is the fact that Saran, who was standing anywhere from 2 to 11 feet in front of Robert Kennedy, could not have been the actual shooter of the fatal shot, since that came from a distance of less than 1 inch from the back of Robert Kennedy's head. You've also heard information about a security guard possibly having fired the fatal shot, a security guard named Thane Eugene Caesar, with links to Lockheed's Burbank facility, at which there was a top secret area in which Thane Eugene Caesar worked, associated with the U-2 project. You're also going to hear about Thane Eugene Caesar's white supremacist connections and his views on Robert Kennedy and people like Robert Kennedy. You're also going to hear about dissembling on Thane Eugene Caesar's part, both about what he actually recalled about the shooting and about the disposition of a .22 mag pistol that was owned by Thane Eugene Caesar, and he has dissembled about just what he did with that pistol and when. We're going to develop that theme, who that security guard was, and also why the many anomalies and the many apparent instances of fudging of evidence were not properly investigated. You're going to hear who is in charge of the, quote, investigation, unquote. However, that will be on side two. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 582, Retrospective on the Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. This is being recorded on January 21st of the year 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.